Good morning, Oregon, and thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Full details are at offbeatoregon.com. Check it out. But first, sit back and relax and let me tell you the story of Oregon's greatest, most audacious mining swindle, involving the now ghost town of Bourne, Oregon, named after one of my very favorite Oregon historical figures, Jonathan Bourne Jr. It was home to a few productive mines, but mostly what Bourne, Oregon, the town, not the man, really specialized in was separating back east suckers from their investment dollars. This story was first published on November 1st, 2010, under the headline, Mountain Ghost Town, Home of Oregon's Greatest Mining Swindle. Here we go. When it comes to attracting swindlers and charlatans, there's nothing quite as effective as gold. And nowhere in Oregon was that fact more clear than the bustling boom town of Bourne, what today is a tiny ghost town 7 miles out of Sumter along the banks of Cracker Creek. Bourne, Oregon was the home of several thousand people, along with a large collection of promising-looking but relatively unproductive mines and a palatial residence and a printing press that, in Miles F. Potter's words, quote, hardly had an opportunity to cool off for 6 years. Bourne's glory days ran from 1900 to 1906, when the mastermind of its multi-million dollar municipal swindle skipped town just hours ahead of the law. Here's the story. In the late 1800s, miners started discovering massive veins of gold in the rugged, remote regions of Oregon's Blue Mountains. In short order, towns like Granite and Sumter sprang up from the rocks, mining companies started setting up shop, and representatives of a species of rugged, hard-drinking, hard-punching men drifted into the region to work the mines. By this time, technological breakthroughs had made it possible to get a lot more gold out of a promising vein than the hopeful prospectors of 1849 had been able to do down in California, but it cost a lot of money to do it. This meant that mines were more valuable to big industrial mining concerns than they were to individual prospectors. And with the fortunes that were being cracked out of the earth at the time, big industrial mining concerns were springing up on stock exchanges all over the world. Financiers in London were buying, sight unseen, mines in places like Copperfield, Oregon, and they were doing really well. It was probably inevitable that somebody in the mining district would figure out sooner or later how to work this system to mine a different resource, not gold from the ground, but investments from suckers. It was a simple supply and demand. There was a market for mining opportunity fantasies, and into that market, with an aim to satisfy, stepped F. Wallace White. White worked the system like the pro he was. First, he hauled a printing press up Cracker Creek to the little boom town of Bourne, which was at that time a fading sister city to nearby Granite and Sumter. A few hundred miners lived there and worked nearby mines, but those mines were playing out, and the freelance miners weren't having nearly as much luck as their colleagues in the other towns. For White, it was the perfect opportunity. Soon his printing press was in motion. Its main purpose was to crank out two newspapers. One, for local consumption, served as a typical small-town weekly paper and was more or less truthful. The other, distributed nationally wherever suckers might congregate, contained almost nothing but lies, a gold mining fantasy that would have been worthy of Walt Disney himself. The two publications looked very similar, only the fantasy version was representing itself as being the non-fantasy version, so that if you were a potential sucker, you would get a copy of the fantasy newspaper and think you were looking at the town's real, actual, live newspaper. This fantasy publication spun fantastic but convincing tales of mammoth gold strikes and huge capital construction projects and rich shipments of bullion. And of course, it offered readers opportunities to buy into this fairyland investment opportunity. Well, with a $7.5 million stock offering, White launched the Sampson Company Limited, with offices in London, New York City, and Bourne, Oregon. He bought up the playing out mines in the Cracker Creek area. When investors came to visit, he'd put on a dazzling show for them at his rustic but lovely terraced mansion with its formal dining room and ballroom, and at the mouths of promising-looking mines guarded by burly men with steel in their eyes and shotguns in their hands. And the money poured in. Meanwhile, other shysters were working the suckers, too, and the marks were starting to get a little smarter. Or perhaps it was just that so many people had been ripped off that they couldn't fool themselves anymore. Or maybe they were running out of money. Who knows? In fact, the legitimate mine financing industry was having trouble raising capital, too, because so many investors simply thought any gold mine in Oregon was crooked. The governor of Pennsylvania actually threatened to outlaw the sale of any Oregon mining stock in his state. In response, the scammers spent ever more money. Full-page newspaper ads started appearing.
"You can enter the Temple of Fortune by purchasing Hiawatha mining stock," screamed one.
There is no record of the Hiawatha having ever produced anything.
"By Consolidated Standard, dividends are sure to follow as day succeeds night. $500,000 worth of rich ore waiting to be processed,"
promised another. Consolidated Standard produced only a tiny trickle of gold. But as for White, by 1906 he was starting to get nervous. What he was doing with his printing press constituted mail fraud. And in his 6 rich and productive years of mining far-distant suckers, he'd made himself a small army of enemies, many of whom had friends in important places. So one night, White simply disappeared from Bourne. He left everything behind but the money. Authorities did finally catch up with him many years later, still diligently operating mail fraud swindles, and no doubt muttering to himself that after this next big score he was going to quit for real this time. As for Bourne, the town melted away. There wasn't enough gold to keep the place busy. Most of the miners went downstream to Sumter, or across the ridge to Granite, out of the hills to Baker City, or even just back west to Portland to get a job in a mill or something. A few families did remain, but today it's empty, and it's not coming back. It's part of a national forest. Well, that's it for today's episode. If you're listening for the first time and want more information about Offbeat Oregon, you can get everything at our central website, which is offbeatoregon.com. There you'll find about 175 columns going back to 2008 when I first started doing these, plus links out to audio and text feeds on RSS, as well as iTunes, the Facebook page, and the Twitter feed. There's even a link to the Amazon page for my book, Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town, which came out this month. The website's also where you'll find the full citations of sources for this story. Sources for today's episode included Miles F. Potter and Stuart Holbrook. All these columns are covered under a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 3.0 license. Details are at offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is a track titled Old Man's Waltz by the Atlas String Band, written by Carmen Ficarra. Hey, are you coming to Corvallis anytime soon? Drop me a line and let's grab a cup of coffee. I love geeking out with fellow history buffs. I'm at Finn at offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, at offbeatoregon. Well, that's it for today. So thanks for listening and have a great day.